everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and alongside me is my co-host, Josh Molina. Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Phil. I was at this show we're about to talk about, I remember it well. I was very excited to be there, so we'll talk about my thoughts about it a little bit later, but this is definitely going to be a unique one for sure.
Absolutely. All right. Well, for our new listeners, Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. And on today's episode, we will be discussing Strikeforce Los Angeles, which took place on June 16th, 2010 at the Nokia Theater in, you guessed it, Los Angeles, California. In the main event, ruthless Robbie Lawler would tangle with Babalu Sobral in a catchweight bout. In the co-main event, Cyborg Santos would battle Dream welterweight champion Mary Soromskis. Also on the card would be Tim Kennedy versus Trevor Prangley and KJ Nunes versus Connor Hune. Pretty short card. There was only six fights on the entire card, including two undercard bouts. But, some pretty good fights. I enjoyed this.
Hey, Phil, let me interrupt a little bit earlier today than normally. I just wanted to kind of set the stage a little bit. It's curious because for me, the theme of this show is the fact that, well, it's at the Nokia Theater and it's a smaller setup. It's a different sort of staging area. So I did a little research and looked up the Wrestling Observer and I looked at what Dave Meltzer wrote at this time. And it's interesting, in his writing, he called it a challenger show. So I don't know if initially that was sort of how it was going to be marketed and framed, and then they decided to sort of get rid of that or not, or maybe Meltzer's wrong. I guess that has happened from time to time. I don't know.
Well, I can tell you for a fact he was wrong, because when Scott Coker announced this event, he said that it was going to be a mix of main card fighters and challenger standouts, but he made it clear like this was, you know, a real event, so to speak. This was not a challenger's event. So Meltzer's incorrect on that.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of read a little bit, though, of what he said. He calls it, well, we know this is incorrect, but this is what he wrote. They had a challenger show on 6/16 in Los Angeles at the Nokia Theater. And he talks about how it was impressive. It was impressive because they were working in Los Angeles. You know, it's a big market. LA really only turns out for the major league events. And then, quote, Meltzer says, "It was a quick show with only six matches. I'm not sure if they did a change in presentation because of the unique theater setup or they tried a new concept. It was very old school studio wrestling. Think early 80s Georgia Championship Wrestling with Gordon Solie and Freddie Miller on Techwood Drive, with the announcers at the podium and the live crowd could hear them between falls and do interviews at the podium." And I was there live, so it was definitely striking. It was not at all what I expected before walking into the theater to think, oh, wow, you can actually set up an MMA card this way. But just a little context to what this show looked like.
Yeah, that's some cool insights. And it definitely, I wouldn't put it at like Georgia Championship Wrestling level, because that's a couple hundred people and this was 5,000 people. But being that it was in a theater, that made the crowd sound a lot louder. And it just definitely seemed more intensive. And, you know, look, this took place during E3, basically video game event that they do every year. And it's a huge, huge event. And I mean, you could see some crossover. I think there'd be probably more crossover today than all the way back in 2010. But, I think they took kind of a risk for doing something like this. But I thought it turned out really well from an optics perspective. You know, the fights were, you know, there was nothing earth shattering in the fights or any, no title fights or, you know, really anything like that. But I thought it was a decent overall card. So let's jump into it. I did want to mention Inside the Hexagon is a proud member of the Evergreens Podcast or the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check out other shows on the network at evergreenpodcast.com. But yeah, let's talk about the last card Strikeforce event that took place before this, Heavy Artillery. That took place in St. Louis in May of 2010. On that card, Fajal Cavalcante had established himself as perhaps the next contender for King Mo's light heavyweight title, and Jacare Souza had possibly lined himself up as the next contender for the middleweight belt, which we were waiting to see what was going to happen there because Jake Shields was still the champion, but it was really seeming like he was going to sign with the UFC, which obviously would have put the middleweight belt up for grabs. And then in the main event, Alistair Overeem had returned to Strikeforce for the first time in over 2.5 years to defend his heavyweight belt. He had TKO'd Brett Rogers, then said he'd plan to be back soon. However, we would not see him for another year. Leading up to this event, this card would take place only 10 days before Fedor versus Verdun, which marked the closest major Strikeforce card, where basically two Strikeforce cards occurred one after the other. This was the first time that it had taken place this quickly. So very, very interesting. The LA card, again, will be set at the 2010 Electronic Entertainment Expo, also known as E3, which is a big-time trade event for the video game industry. Pretty unique atmosphere, and it made sense since Strikeforce had partnered up with EA Sports for the EA MMA video game, and they showed some clips and that sort of thing. Josh, real quick, so you, because you were at the Fedor card too, right? So you were in LA, and then 10 days later, you were in San Jose for this for the Fedor event as well. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I live in Santa Barbara, so what that means is about 90 minutes from Los Angeles. And I think what happened, Phil, and you can appreciate this, is that I wasn't actually part of press row for this fight, but Mike Aframowicz had comped me some tickets for the Strikeforce show in LA. And I think at this time I was probably still doing fighter profiles. I had interviewed Connor Kuhn, KJ Nunes, Tim Kennedy, Trevor Prangley, a lot of the fighters on this show, Renato Sobral, you know, so I think that for this, I was just sort of there to sort of like, you know, part of our compensation at that time was, you know, go check it out. And so, yeah, it was not a big deal for me to go and watch the show. And then San Jose is about 4.5 hours away, but what I wanted to go because that was, you know, as we'll talk about it, Fedor, and I was really looking forward to Fedor winning. But you know, if you have the opportunity to see Fedor, you know, even today, I think if you have an opportunity to see him and you're an MMA fan, you take it. So that's why I was at.
I don't blame you. All right. Well, when this event, the LA event that we're discussing, when that was announced in April, the main event was actually supposed to feature Robbie Lawler versus Jason Mayhem Miller. However, after Miller's antics at Strikeforce Nashville that precipitated an in-cage brawl that essentially got Strikeforce kicked off of CBS, he was pulled in favor of Sobral. Interestingly, despite taking the bout taking place at a catch weight of 195 pounds, the winner of Lawler-Sobral would be given the opportunity to challenge for the title in their respective weight class. So Lawler at the 185-pound weight class and Sobral at the 205-pound weight class. Things were still up in the air, as I mentioned, with middleweight champion Jake Shields. But if he did sign with the UFC, the thought was Scott Coker was saying that Lawler and probably Jacare would likely face off for the vacant belt, though a tournament might happen. But basically, they pulled Mayhem Miller not just because of his antics, but because they were expecting him to be suspended. And they, the way that Coker put it, was like this was not just going to be a slap on the wrist; he's going to be out for quite a while. Ironically, he would end up getting only a 3-month suspension, and he was fined with somewhere between $5,000 and $7,500, which is about as slap on the wrist as you can get for that. But he wouldn't have been eligible to compete in LA anyway, so it made sense for they made a good move by pulling him from the event. Another marquee bout on the card that was supposed to showcase Bobby Lashley taking on the very massive Ron Sparks did not happen. Lashley would injure his knee and require surgery, so the bout would be scrapped and replaced with a middleweight bout between rising star Tim Kennedy and the ultra-tough Trevor Prangley. Tim Kennedy was a unique addition to this card and someone who could really be a star for Strikeforce. I mean, he'd gone 2-0 inside the hexagon on challengers cards. He had finished both of those fights, and now he had a shot at a quote-unquote big show. Kennedy was a U.S. Army Special Forces sniper with the 19th Special Forces outfit based in San Antonio. He had toured the Middle East several times. He'd earned the Army's bronze medal star for valor under fire. I mean, a true American hero, and I mean, you could really make a case for Kennedy being Strikeforce's next signature 185-pound star. And besides the lightweight division, I mean, I think that's the division that they were the strongest in. And so this was a real opportunity for him. KJ Nunes was supposed to get a chance at revenge against Charles Crazy Horse Bennett on Fedor versus Verdun. Bennett had handed Nunes his first loss several years prior. However, Crazy Horse would pull out of the fight for undisclosed reasons. So instead, Nunes was matched up with Connor Kuhn, and they would compete on the LA card. Josh, let me ask you real quick. Are you... Have you seen Charles Crazy Horse Bennett fight? Are you familiar with him at all?
Let me answer this and say that I've read about him and I've heard about him. I know that he's got sort of a legendary reputation, but I'm not sure which incident you're going to refer to here.
Well, no, yeah. I'm just more asking overall, because I don't think he ever got a UFC fight. If you look at his record now, it is ridiculous how many fights he's lost. What type of fight streak he's on, but the dude is just always really, really entertaining. I really enjoyed watching him in Pride, because he would, like, when I say mug for the camera, like at the beginning when the ref is going over the rules, he would be like goofing off and like looking at the camera and like making faces and stuff like that. And just, I mean, always really, really entertaining, but kind of crazy, and lots of legal issues. I'm looking at his record now, at least on Wikipedia. His record is 30-42.
Wow.
He has not won a fight since September of 2016. He's lost 12 straight fights. He fought tonight. That's right. He main evented. That's right. As we record this, this is Saturday, June 19th. That's right. Wow. He main evented the bare knuckle MMA event that Gamebred Masvidal, George Masvidal, just put on. His first fight as a promoter, and it looks like Jason Knight submitted him in the first round, which makes sense. He's been submitted in four straight fights dating back to 2018. He also got into bare knuckle, and he is 0-3. One fight each, 2018, 2019, 2020. So he loses a lot, but man, he is just always really, really entertaining, extremely athletic. Like, he would win and then jump up on the top of the cage and do a standing moonsault off there. And I mean, just extremely game. He's fought some really big names: Takanari Gomi, Uriah Faber, Jeff Kern, Tatsuya Kawajiri, who he lost to all those guys, but he did knock out KJ Nunes in the first round. And so this was going to be an opportunity for Nunes to get revenge. But, you know, like I said, Bennett was unavailable for whatever reason. So
let me ask you this. To get Crazy Horse a win so he can retire, do we book him against CM Punk or Bob Sapp?
Yeah, I honestly would give him a better chance against Bob Sapp than I would see him. I'm not even joking. I really think I would probably, because all I'd have to do with Sapp is like run around the cage, and eventually Sapp would get tired and just tap out.
Start crying.
Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, I legit, that's no joke, I think that Punk would have a better chance of beating him. So, which is really sad. But of course, getting back to this, nearly impossible to bring up KJ Nunes without mentioning Nick Diaz. As far as back then, I mean, the two had fought for the Elite XC 160 pound belt 3 years prior in 2010, with Nunes winning by doctor stoppage after cutting up Nick's face with strikes. And as you can imagine, Nick Diaz neither of the Diaz brothers ever are happy with a fight getting stopped because they're cut, even though they cut fairly easily. And Diaz was not happy with the decision. He flipped off pretty much the entire state of Hawaii as he was leaving the cage. And Nunes was asked about rematching Diaz around this time, and he expressed that he was all for it. In fact, I believe he said that he had offered or agreed or something, and then somebody in Nick Diaz's camp had said no. I don't know exactly the situation, but they would end up rematching, which we'll get to eventually. All right, so around this time, as far as what was going on in the UFC, same situation, the same champions, basically. We had UFC lightweight champion was Frankie Edgar. GSP was the undisputed welterweight champion. Anderson Silva, still the middleweight champ. And then Mauricio Shogun Hua was the champion. And then the light heavyweight champion. And then Brock Lesnar was the undisputed heavyweight champion. The closest UFC event to take place to this card that we're talking about was UFC 115. Historic event for sure, although for somewhat of a sad reason. It took place on June 12th, 2010, just a few days before Strikeforce Los Angeles. And it was set in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. The event was a huge success financially, drawing 17,669 fans for a gate of $4.2 million, as well as a pay-per-view buy rate of 520,000. The main event was originally supposed to feature Chuck Liddell taking on Tito Ortiz for the third time. However, Ortiz would be forced to pull out due to a neck injury that required surgery. So instead, former UFC middleweight champion Rich Franklin would step in to face the Iceman. And you know, we'll talk about that in just a second. But also on the main card, Carlos Condit would TKO a then 20-year-old Rory McDonald. And Mirko Krokop would secure a very rare submission victory for himself, choking out Pat Barry with a rear naked choke. And then in the main event, Liddell would suffer a third straight knockout loss as Franklin would punch his lights out. And this would end Liddell's run with the UFC. He had first fought for them all the way back in 1998. He fought for a few other promotions early on. He fought a couple times in Pride, although that was as a UFC fighter. And really one of the UFC's true signature stars. I mean, one of the guys, I don't think I ever saw him in a boring fight. He'll go down in history as one of the greatest light heavyweights of all time. And he was also a bridge from the old school, no rules, NHB days of MMA and, you know, all the way up to the network TV area, network TV era. But, you know, the Ken and Tito fights, Ken Shamrock, Tito Ortiz fights from 2002, and then going into Tito's feud with Chuck Liddell, and then, you know, Chuck having some really good fights, I think three fights with Randy Couture. I mean, those were the things that really, those were the events that really kept the UFC afloat until The Ultimate Fighter in 2005. And I mean, they were the main stars. Those were the guys that drew. And so it was a big deal. So seeing, you know, Chuck go out on three straight knockout losses was, you know, that's not fun, but it's just, that's the way MMA is. That's the name of the game.
Yeah. You know, Chuck Liddell, you know, he's from Santa Barbara. He went to school here.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
You know, and he, you know, trained San Luis Obispo. So I just remember back then, of course, you know, anyone who listens knows that, you know, we're both big pro wrestling fans. I'm also a pro wrestling fan. But back around this time, well, not this time, but during the Chuck Liddell era, which is like 2005-ish, 2006, right around there. I mean, these were the household names. They were the Hulk Hogan and Roddy Piper of MMA. I mean, this was Chuck Liddell, it was Tito Ortiz. It was these, you know, it was Randy Couture. These were the names that got your casual fan to like pay attention. And so these guys are, they're groundbreakers for sure. And of course, you know, now the UFC is this billion-dollar company, but it started with just, you know, those three played a huge part in it. Of course, and since you brought up Tito Ortiz, and I don't want to stray too much, we could do our own podcast on Tito Ortiz, but I'm sure you're aware he got elected to the Huntington Beach, California, city council, and then he quit. He resigned. So it's like, wow, it's just like, you know, just goes to show you, you be a fighter. Don't try to do politics, because that world is upside. That's even more upside down than the fight world.
Well, I mean, some would say Tito's more upside down than anything else, but...
Well, I mean, he's upside down
and politics
is upside down.
He seemed to be pretty far out there. Yeah, he seemed to be pretty far out there. Even, I mean, even for somebody like myself, who I consider myself to be kind of a conservative-leaning libertarian or libertarian-leaning conservative or something along those lines, but... He is way far right of me. So,
well, he got in trouble because he filed for unemployment.
Yeah, unemployment. Yeah.
While working for the city of Huntington Beach. So,
kind of a bad look. Kind of a bad look. Yeah.
But an MMA and UFC icon, no doubt.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Like I said, they were the, you said the same thing, but essentially they were the main guys. And, you know, Dana was actually Chuck's manager at one point and Tito's manager at one point. So, you know, they've known each other for a long, long time, but I'm sure it pained Dana to say in the press conference afterwards that Chuck will never fight in the UFC again, that, you know, that's it. And I really wish he hadn't come back in 2018 for that really lackluster fight against Tito. I wish he'd just stayed retired, but, you know, it's just, it is what it is, and it's really hard. Once you get bit by that bug, it's really hard to let it go. So, but much, much, much respect to the Iceman, Chuck Liddell, for everything that he accomplished in the sport of MMA, for sure. All right, well, let's get back to the event. As mentioned earlier, Strikeforce Los Angeles would take place on June 16th, 2010, at the Nokia Theater in LA during the E3 event. 5,259 fans would be in attendance for a gate of $418,000. At this point, Steven Quadros and Pat Miletich would normally join Mauro Ranallo on Challengers cards, while Frank Shamrock and Gus Johnson would work the larger events with Mauro. This time, however, Quadros and Miletich would join Ranallo on commentary, and once again, Jimmy Lennon Jr. would be the ring announcer. The event drew an estimated 164,000 viewers with a peak of 197,000 on Showtime.
A couple of things. Apparently, Dave Bautista, speaking of WWE, was, I guess, out at this point. He was kind of fed up with pro wrestling. and he was interested in getting into MMA. And so he met Scott Coker at this show. They talked. This is from the Wrestling Observer. Bautista was at the show, Dave Bautista, or Batista, if you're a wrestling character. But apparently, what Dave Meltzer wrote was he was talking with Strikeforce CEO Scott Coker after the show, but it was just the two guys introducing themselves for the first time. The one thing is, I just don't see him getting the kind of money he would want in MMA because he's been making in the $2 million per year range. And that's why any kind of leaving other than a sabbatical at his age, he was 41 at the time, doesn't make sense unless he's just sick of it and has saved enough money to where it's not an issue. With the kind of years he's had the past 5 or 6, he would have saved a big nest egg, but he does live large. He's got a finite number of years left, and he's exceedingly unlikely to be able to come anywhere close to that kind of income doing anything else other than wrestling. That's Dave Meltzer. But it's interesting that Bautista was thinking about doing MMA for Strikeforce. He had floated it out there in interviews, and he actually met Coker at this event. And you know, Bautista did do one MMA fight. I don't even remember the promotion that it was, but
I
it
can
was.
tell you all about
Uh-oh. Were you there, Phil?
No,
Did you
no,
float
no,
it?
no. I know. I'm just looking at his Wikipedia page as we're discussing this. But yeah, actually, so I'm looking at his Wikipedia page. He was yeah. He quit. He did that whole angle where he was saying that he was injured, which he actually was. And Bret Hart was the Raw general manager and said that you got to face Randy Orton to qualify for a shot at the WWE Championship, and he basically quit instead. And then later said in an interview that he left WWE at that point because he did not like the direction the company was going. And that was in May. And so this event took place in June. So it makes sense that, you know, a couple months later, he's thinking about his next steps. So he did end up having a fight in 2012. I remember I had no, you know, I didn't, like, I wasn't part of the, you know, working with the promotion or anything like that. I was out of MMA, I believe, at that point. But he worked for a promotion called CES MMA in Providence, Rhode Island, which I think is still around, if I remember correctly. It's the only fight he ever did. He beat a journeyman named Vince Lacero by TKO in the first round, and basically mounted him. He had his back mount and was punching him. And if you watch it, you can YouTube it, and essentially Lacero did not like something that Batista did when, like, he was on his back. Like, I think he, I don't know. It's like, if you watch it, I can't see what he's so upset about, but he was really, really upset about something. And then Batista got really angry and it was not looking good. And then there's a picture of him at the dais afterwards, given, you know, during the press conference afterwards. So that was it. Like, the thought, I think that they thought he was going to go, you know, keep going, but that was it. He got his one fight, and then he returned. That was in 2012. He returned to WWE the next year and had that the Bautista run the next year. That was not well received. But I did not know that he had talked with Coker. So that's interesting. That, I mean, you imagine seeing seeing Batista versus Bobby Lashley
Oh,
in
man.
I mean, in Strikeforce. I mean, that would have been the place to do that. So that would have been really interesting. So,
Yeah, that would have been probably one round of heavy breathing and Bobby
yeah.
Lashley on top of him
Bobby
until.
Lashley taking him down and pounding him out, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was, you know, good for Batista for trying it, doing the
Yeah.
walk, and deciding he, you know, he's four. I guess he would have been 43 at that time. I mean, that's
Yeah,
old to
yeah,
be MMA
yeah. So
starting.
yeah. Yeah, definitely up there. So makes a lot of sense that he would just do that one and make the walk, and that'd be it. All right, well, let's get to the card itself. Two quick undercard bouts to discuss. 160 pounds, Jeremy Umfries defeated RJ Clifford via technical submission, come by way of rear naked choke at 227 in the second round. RJ Clifford is the name that stands out there in that he ended up going into MMA journalism. I remember pitching him when I was an MMA publicist. Don't know what he's doing today, if he's still involved with MMA, but yeah, transitioned from fighter into the journalism side. And then at 135 pounds, Hugo Sandoval defeated Marcus Kowal via TKO, come by way of strikes at 43 seconds of the second round. All right, let's get to the main card. This is available on UFC Fight Pass, so we were able to see these fights. At 160 pounds, KJ Noon's defeated Connor Huhn via split decision. Huhn was 8-2 coming in. He was coming off a year-long layoff as he'd had knee surgery. Before that, he'd lost an entertaining decision to George Gurgel, a future opponent of KJ Noon's. He took this fight on 12 days' notice after Noon's original opponent, Charles Crazy Horse Bennett, had dropped out. Noon's was also 8-2. He had returned to MMA after a nearly two-year hiatus to win a decision victory over Andre Amade in Dream in Japan in March of 2010. Interestingly, Noon's was actually representing Strikeforce in that fight. He had signed with the promotion in 2009, and his appearance in Dream was part of the partnership between the two promotions. Prior to that, Noon's had been the last Elite XC 160-pound champion, defending the title successfully against Eve Edwards after besting Nick Diaz for the belt. All right, so let's get to the fight itself. KJ was competing in pro boxing at this time. He'd also been a kickboxer, but he at this time was focusing on both pro boxing and MMA. He wanted to be a champion in both. Huhn was an Eddie Bravo BJJ black belt, which is very impressive because Eddie is one of the best BJJ guys in the world. Very entertaining first round.
Is he the same guy that thinks the earth is flat?
Yep, that would be that guy. One of Joe Rogan's absolute best friends.
Oh, okay.
But he's an incredible Brazilian jiu-jitsu player. Amazing guy.
Wow,
so I think his gym is 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu or something like that. So
I've only seen him talking about aliens. And
yeah, he's definitely a weird guy. Likes to get high. He's an out there guy for sure. But he knows what he's doing when it comes to jiu-jitsu. So to get your BJJ black belt from him, you've got to be really, really good. So I assume, even though Huhn didn't really show it in this fight too much because he wanted to stand and bang apparently, but apparently he's got to be really good on the ground. So very entertaining first round. Both fighters landed some good strikes. They got right into it. No feeling out process to this one at all. With about 2 minutes left, Huhn landed a really nice takedown. Noon's tried to stand up, but Huhn dragged him back down. Huhn also got the figure four body lock on for a while, and he was really squeezing Noon's, and something interesting happened there, which we'll talk about in just a bit. Really tough round to call, especially with Noon's dropping Huhn at the buzzer with a shot, but with the shot that he landed, plus the takedown and all the work that, or yeah, I'm sorry, with some of the shots that he landed and the takedown and all the work he put in on the ground, I gave it to the first round to Huhn 10-9. Great second round, which took place almost solely on the feet. Noon's clearly hurt Huhn midway through the round with a solid right hand, but to Huhn's credit, he not only hung in there, he started to throw back with power, and at the very end of the round, Huhn landed a nice takedown, but I would still give it to Noon's 10-9. And in the third round, Huhn's face was cut up pretty bad. He started going for takedowns more often, but Noon's was able to stuff most of them. Huhn was hurt and tired, and Noon's was picking him apart, but what a battle this was. And, you know, in the end, I think Noon's was the better fighter and took at least two of the three rounds. Big round of applause for both fighters when they were done. The crowd seemed really, really into it. Like I said, them being so close together seemed to make it louder in there. But Noon's got a split decision victory. Somehow, some way, one of the judges scored this 30-27 for Huhn. I don't know what fight that guy was watching. I could see it maybe 29-28 for Huhn if like one of the judges did that. But the other two judges scored it, I think, 29-28 for Noon's. And one guy gave it 30-27 for Huhn, which is just insane.
Maybe that judge scored the Rory McDonald PFL fight.
Yeah, the Gleison Tebow Rory McDonald fight. Yeah.
Okay, I had the fight 29-28 for Noon's. And I think Connor Huhn won the first round, and then Noon's just was better the final two. I really like this fight. I thought it was a great fight. Noon's is such a good offensive boxer. I mean, by offensive, I mean he's such a good striker. And, you know, he's got slick jab, nice right hand, great counter punches. He's really comfortable in there. And he's one of the fighters that I really enjoyed watching. I wish he had fought more. I wish he had a longer career. I wish he had a greater stage in either Strikeforce or the UFC. Because he very much is like a Josh Thompson kind of guy. He just, like, looked like he had fun in there. And he just was very comfortable. He's very relaxed. And he was always sort of just, you know, just like, I guess he had that kind of Hawaiian mentality where he was appreciative of the moment. On the other hand, I really like Connor Huhn too. You know, he was a good fighter. I thought he stretched Noon's in that first round. You know, I don't know that he was close to getting a submission, but he definitely was putting a lot of pressure on him. And he was making KJ work, no doubt. So I mean, he looked good. I thought he fought a great fight here, and I don't think he won, but it was really close. Obviously, the fact that Connor had the crimson mask, that blood that never plays well in your favor. It tells the judges, whether it's, subconscious or subliminally, that, hey, this guy's losing the fight. This guy's getting beat up. KJ doesn't have that much blood all over his face. So, Nunes did more damage with his striking, very Nick Diaz-like, but probably, in my opinion, a better boxer than Nick Diaz. He doesn't slap as much. I think he actually, puts a little more power in his punches. But I like both of these fighters, and like I said, I wish Nunes would have had a longer career on a grander stage, because I really enjoyed watching him fight.
Well, he did. I mean, he got a long run with Strikeforce, and then he had a 5 or 6 fight run with UFC, which I had forgotten about. But Nunes did get a run in the UFC. Just he always seemed at this point in his career to lose when it was, the elite guys. And he was matched up with Josh Thompson at one point, I believe, and I don't think the fight happened. But I would have loved to have seen that. I would have. Yeah, I would have. I really enjoyed watching Nunes. I mean, it was just. Seemed to be impossible for him to be in a boring fight. And Hume definitely impressed me too. I really enjoyed this fight. I think it was probably the best fight on this card. And yeah, I enjoyed it. But if you enjoyed KJ Nunes, I want to let you know that next week I'm interviewing him. We actually have already recorded it, but he told me it was his first interview since his last fight in 2016, which is really crazy. His first interview in 5 years. And during my chat with him, he said that the first round figure four body lock that Hune had put on him here popped out a rib, and to this day, it still sticks out. And in fact, this is a Hawaiian saying this, he can't surf because of that rib sticking out, which is just insane. So during the interview, he's like, "So thanks, Connor, for basically keeping me from ever surfing again," which is just crazy. So make sure you tune in next week. You're not going to want to miss that interview. We talk about his 2 fights with Nick Diaz, his run with Strikeforce, and just what he's up to today. He's a fireman today, and it was a great chat. So make sure you check that out. But Nunes will be back in Strikeforce just a couple of months later, while Hune would return in 2011. All right, next bout, 185 pounds. Tim Kennedy defeated Trevor Prangley via submission, come by way of rear naked choke at 3:35 of the first round. Prangley, 22-5, was coming off an unfortunate draw with Carl Lomusu after an accidental thumb to his opponent's eye had ended the bout prematurely. Prior to that, the South African strongman had won 5 straight bouts, including his last scrap in Strikeforce, which had been a win over Anthony Ruiz at Strikeforce at the Playboy Mansion 2, which I believe was in 2008. So this was his first time back with the promotion in over a year and a half. Kennedy was 11-2 and had a win over Mayhem Miller early in his career. He'd competed several times in the IFL, winning their middleweight title before joining Strikeforce in 2009. He'd finished Nick Thompson with punches on the second Challengers card, and then had submitted Zach Cummings at the third Challengers event. Now he had a chance to make it 3 straight in Strikeforce and set himself up as a contender for the middleweight crown. Getting into the fight itself, the two clinched almost immediately, with Prangley landing a very, very nice whizzer kind of hip trip takedown. Kennedy was able to stand back up, but Prangley took him back down again. However, Kennedy reversed course and got back up, then landed a lift and drop takedown of his own. And this would be proved to be the beginning of the end, as Kennedy started working the mat, improving his position. Prangley started to stand up with Kennedy on his back, but Kennedy apparently snuck in a rear naked choke, and Prangley apparently tapped. It was really hard to see from the live camera angle, so it was a little bit anticlimactic, but when they show the replay, you could see it a lot clearer. Very, very nice win for Tim Kennedy.
Tim Kennedy, what a great fighter. I think he was underrated, and I think that the UFC missed a big opportunity in how they marketed him. As you had mentioned earlier, he had this decorated military career. He was a sniper. He never really talked too much about his kills. I guess they don't. They're not supposed to, but he was a high-level Army Ranger sniper. He's probably still doing that. He had this incredible body, just this amazing story for them to tell. And he was also a really good grappler. He was strong, and he had a really good sort of fight personality. It was very marketable. He had a little bit of Conor McGregor in him in terms of his attitude. Obviously, not to that degree, but Kennedy was kind of a jerk, okay? He was definitely very much a guy who was arrogant. He liked to stay in charge. He liked to be the one who was setting the tone, and he promoted fights really well. So, I mean, I thought he was going to have a long career as a champion. He did end up fighting Lee Rockhold. He did end up, in the UFC. Probably his biggest challenge in my, in my assessment was he was overly technical at times. He was too comfortable sort of winning fights on decisions and being the better athlete. He didn't face a lot of guys who were better athletes than him. He was a much better athlete. But I think he kind of had a bad ending there to his career. I don't know, Phil, if you remember the Yoel Romero fight. This isn't the Tim Kennedy podcast, but he got a bad break where he thought he knocked Romero out, and then Romero got some extra time, and then you're the adrenaline of thinking you won, and all of a sudden you didn't, or you think you're about to win, and then you get knocked out. I mean, that was heartbreaking for him. But I always liked Tim Kennedy. Notwithstanding his extraordinarily conservative viewpoints, this is fighting. I don't really care about any of that stuff. This guy was a fighter, and I enjoyed watching him fight.
I'm a huge fan of his both a fighter and as a personality. My political viewpoints probably match up more with his than yours too, but I think he's great. I would highly recommend anybody to go listen to his last interview with Joe Rogan on the Joe Rogan podcast. It was very inspirational as far as taking care of your body and just going after it. I mean, it was I know there's a lot out there about toxic masculinity and that sort of thing. But there's just something about the way that he lives his life that's just very, again, inspirational that, just get after it and getting spending time in nature and all that stuff. And he just seems to really have it together. In fact, I emailed him about coming on the show and he agreed to come on. So we're planning to have him on in the future. And after I heard him on Rogan's podcast, I emailed him and just said, hey, I really enjoyed that. And I asked him, I think I asked him if there's any books he would recommend. And he gave me a couple, a couple. He did. He gave me a suggestion on that. So, really good guy to me. He's always been really good, and I really, really enjoy watching him fight and hearing him talk. And he the Romero thing. I remember watching that. It's just like, man, he really got the short end of the stick there. That was just really unfortunate. But
Well, Phil, at the risk of offending all of your woke, progressive constituents, Tim Kennedy is a man.
he
I
is a
mean,
man.
he is a man. Like he is everything that if you strive to be manly, you want to be like him. And I mean, there's a lot of fighters, and there's a lot of great fighters, but what this guy does in the military, and obviously his conditioning, I mean, this he's a he's, there's no doubt he's a role model.
Yeah, no doubt. This is a guy, he's masculine without being trying to be. He just he's a real man, and yeah, he's seen and done things that the vast majority of the population will never see or do, and I give him a lot of credit for. I'm sure he has his struggles, but just having the type of viewpoint that he has, and just knowing who he is, he's very inspirational to me. So I'm a big fan of his, and I don't care what people think. But anyways, back to the fight itself. Prangley would be back in Strikeforce in 2011. Kennedy now has this 3-fight win streak in Strikeforce. He does get a crack at the vacant Strikeforce middleweight title a couple of months after this, matching up with Jacare Souza, and I can't wait to cover that event. All right, we're at the co-main event. 170 pounds, Evangelista Cyborg Santos defeated Marius Zaromskis via TKO, coming by way of head kick and punches at 238 of the first round. Zaromskis was the Dream welterweight champion, held a record of 14-4 coming in. He had lost via TKO to Strikeforce welterweight champion Nick Diaz in January on the their Miami event, but he had won 5 straight before that loss. Cyborg, not really an impressive record, 17-13, but he was coming off a win. Despite, however, that was his only win in the last 3 bouts, which included a split decision loss to Joey Villaseñor on a Strikeforce Challengers card. All right, this is a quick one. Heavy shots from both fighters early on, with Cyborg landing a solid left hook that staggered Zaromskis. Cyborg was really landing some counter leg kicks, really solid stuff. And Cyborg then lands a right high kick, then clips Zaromskis with another left. Then comes a very scintillating finish as Zaromskis clearly rocked. Flies in with this flying knee, and Cyborg tried to time a left hook that missed, but then landed a straight right follow-up that just, I mean, landed flush and put Zaromskis down for good. Followed up with a couple shots in the mat, but what a great finish! And I mean, Cyborg looked great in this fight to me.
We will probably disagree on this, but I did not like that ending. But I don't think it's because the fight should have gone longer. I think it was probably because I hated the camera angle. And it was kind of a theme of at least a couple of fights. We
Yeah.
saw it
Yeah, that's a
here.
good point. That's a good point.
And then we saw it with Trevor Prangley. I mean,
Yeah.
Prangley collapsed. And we didn't see until the replay, he actually tapped out on the right-hand side. So it sort of
Right.
looked like what happened there. And this one, he clearly, went for a knee, and then Cyborg caught him, and he was out. And then, but you didn't see the punch. You just kind of saw,
Yeah.
you just,
Yep.
Zeromoski's, you saw him just kind of fall. So you're like, it almost could have been a slip because he had was leaning in with the knee. It was kind of awkward, so I don't know. I felt in real time, I'm like, oh, they stopped that too early. This guy could have maybe gotten, scrambled, gotten up or something, but it might have been just the camera angle. It was tough to see how bad the punch really connected. He was hurt. It probably would have ended, but I don't know. I felt like I just, there was a great finish there that I didn't fully see. That's my problem with that fight.
Yeah, no, that's legit, and you're exactly right. The Kennedy Prangley one, it was like, well, he must have just the way their bodies were. The only thing it could have been pretty much was, either a neck crank or a rear naked choke, and you didn't see the tap. So it was like, wait, did he tap? I mean, Prangley definitely did not protest in any way. I mean, he went down face first and was clearly, in pain or recovering or whatever. So, but it was definitely anticlimactic, like I said. And this is similar. I thought for sure that he had landed this perfectly timed left hand, but then I was like, but he didn't. Zoromsky seemed to not react right away, so I thought maybe their heads had clashed, and so it was kind of weird. And then I've written out as like perfectly timed left hand, and then they showed the replay, and I had to change what I wrote because it wasn't. He missed on the left hand, but then in a follow up straight right that landed right on Zoromsky's chin and knocked him backwards, and then a couple shots, and that was it. But yeah, I agree. It does make it a little less impressive. I was really impressed. I don't know if you noticed, but Cyborg's wife at that time was Chris Cyborg, and Chris picked him up and spun him around in the cage, which kind of made me laugh. Yeah, I don't know if she was juicing at that point or not.
I would have picked her for sure if they ever fought
Oh,
intergender
yeah. Oh,
fight.
yeah. Yeah, no question. But Zoromskis will be back for a Challengers card later in the year, but that would be it for him in Strikeforce. He's 40 years old today as we record this and actually still competing and won a fight this past November to bring his record to 22-9. Cyborg would earn a shot at Nick Diaz's welterweight title as a result of his win here, which would take place, but not for a while, 6 months later, January of 2011. All right, here we go. Main event time. Catchweight bout of 195 pounds. Hinato Babalu Sobral defeated Robbie Lawler via unanimous decision. Former Strikeforce light heavyweight champion Babalu was 35-8, coming in with 18 submissions and 5 KOs. He hadn't competed in 10 months, losing his Strikeforce light heavyweight title to Gegard Mousasi the previous August. Prior to that bout, he'd won 5 straight. Lawler, for his part, was 17-5 with 14 knockouts and 1 submission. He was coming off an incredible win over Melvin Manhoef earlier in the year in a fight where Ruthless had landed only 2 punches, but they were the only ones that he needed as he turned the Dutch kickboxer's lights out in violent fashion at the end of the bout. It was during the first round. Before that, he had tapped out to Jake Shields in a disappointing fight for Ruthless Robbie Lawler. He had his usual camp in Iowa to had I'm sorry, Lawler had actually left his usual camp in Iowa in Bettendorf to train with Aaron Simpson, Ryan Bader, and several other high-level fighters to prep for this fight. It was not a permanent move, but one that Lawler said he enjoyed and would be happy to go back to again. All right. Being this was E3, a big-time video game conference, it made sense for Strikeforce to show some footage from the EA Sports MMA video game, which they did before this bout. Once the bell rang, the two clinched early on. About halfway through, Lawler landed a left hand that appeared to cut Babalu under the eye. Babalu answered with a nice takedown, but Lawler got up right away. Babalu landed a nice leg kick that had to remind Lawler of tearing knee cartilage against Melvin Manhoef during getting those brutal. Oh man, those leg kicks were just brutal in that Manhoef fight. And when I saw Babalu throw one that Lawler kicked his leg out, you know, kind of in trying to cushion and take the kick. It just reminded me of that. It had to have reminded him of that. Very tough round to call, but I'd probably lean towards Bobolu 10-9. Interestingly, they interviewed Strikeforce light heavyweight champion King Mo during the break between the first and second rounds, and he was asked who he was pulling for, and he said Bobolu. But interesting, as he was a friend and training partner, but if Bobolu won, he'd have the right to face King Mo for the belt. So that's kind of, you know, well, you're pulling for the guy that you know is your buddy, of course, but then you might have to face him. In the second, Lawler seemed really intent on pushing the pace, and he was stalking Bobolu, landed some nice shots. Bobolu tried for a takedown, but Lawler stayed on his feet, throwing strikes while Bobolu had his leg in his hand, which was, you know, basically hopping up and down 1 foot. However, Bobolu started responding, and Lawler seemed to be tiring, perhaps. I mean, he did that thing where he tried to act like he was hurt. Josh, you've talked about this in the past. He was trying to draw Bobolu in, but the Brazilian did not bite, and the commentators, especially Pat Miletich, called it out on commentary. In fact, I believe Pat said that he'd been in a movie with Robbie, you know, a couple years prior, and said he wasn't that good of an actor. So, and it showed there. But you know, it was weird watching Robbie. I mean, he started to hang back. I don't know if he was being hurt by Bobolu strikes, but Ruthless just completely took his foot off the gas, and he seemed to be waiting for Bobolu to do something so he could counter. Meanwhile, Bobolu just pouring it on, and crowds responding, chanting his name. And keep in mind, Bobolu owns and operates a gym in the area, so he was the local favorite. I'd probably give the second round to Bobolu once again, 10-9. But Robbie just seemed incapable of stringing together some combinations. It just seemed like he wasn't, I don't say he wasn't mentally there, but it was, he just seemed to have trouble putting it together mentally in the fight. And this is kind of the, you know, look, he's a great fighter, a former UFC champion, but I really think this is what keeps him from being named amongst the greatest 185 pounders of all time. Was just, I feel like the mental side of it wasn't always a strong suit for him. I mean, obviously tons of killer instinct and tons of heart and all that stuff, but, and obviously very skilled. But he just, I feel like the mental part of the game just escaped him sometimes, and I think that was on full display in this fight. But then in the third and final round, though his face was showing almost all of the damage that was inflicted, Bobolu continued to press the action. You could see some very deep bruising on Robbie Lawler's left side, and it looked bad. Bobolu's body kicks had clearly landed where he wanted them to, and Bobolu was out striking the slugger, no question. Lawler was just never able to land the big shot that he needed at the end. He was pressing, he was going for it, but Bobolu kept him at bay long enough to get to the final bell and clearly secured the decision victory in the process. You know, it was a decent, entertaining fight. I would have liked to have seen something more decisive, of course. But, you know, it was a good fight. The two embraced immediately afterwards, and, you know, it was interesting that Quadros tallied the fight for Bobolu while Miletich actually thought Lawler won. But in the end, the judges saw it as a unanimous decision victory for Bobolu, and I had to agree.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about what you brought up with Robbie Lawler. This was definitely the bad version of Robbie Lawler. And I think that's what you're getting at when you're talking about sort of his legacy. Was Robbie Lawler looked amazing in some fights, particularly after he returned to the UFC, and I think he might have switched camps, and he got more in touch with his power, and he really, you know, since it's the man show, he manned up, you know, he really became more aggressive and more of a knockout artist. But there's so many of these fights in Robbie's career where you're just sort of waiting for him to do something, and then he never did it. And I think that's part of the challenge. So I don't know if that's a mental lapse. If it's, you know, some athletes are so used to winning, you know, they could only fight their way. And when they don't get their way, they quit. Not like tap out quit, but they just stop fighting, or they give up, or they just end up looking for one thing to win.
Yeah, they don't have the ability to change it up and do something else in the fight, you know?
Yeah, you know, they're not versatile enough. And that was sort of Robbie's thing. Was Robbie looked like one of the best 185-pounders in the world at times. But, you know, there were other, what was it, the Hendricks fights that, you know, he had that? Or there's a Stephen Thompson? I mean, these were fights, you know, like, you know, in the UFC, he looked incredible. But then he would struggle with a guy like Bobolu, who, fairly certain, 9 times out of 10, he would knock him into next week if he actually fought him, you know? So In this fight, it was the version of Robbie Lawler that he really could not, he really couldn't compete with Sobral. He couldn't work with his movement, and I don't know. Maybe having a different camp really didn't, or different training partners, maybe that didn't work. I don't know.
Yeah, it was definitely not his best showing, and yeah. But they interviewed Babalu afterwards. He said that instead of King Mo, he wanted Dan Henderson in a rematch from about 11 years prior. We would end up seeing that later in the year, which was kind of an interesting. He basically said, you know, he's my friend, and I'm talking about Mo, and so I'm not going to take a title shot. So I'm going to go after a guy that I lost to 11 years ago. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I love King Mo, but if you have the option of fighting Dan Henderson or King Mo in 2010, pick King Mo.
Yeah, seriously. I just, it's hard for me to agree with the idea that Babalu is not going to take just the title shot. You know, it's more money and chance to be the first two-time champion. And, you know, yeah, I don't agree with that. But, you know, I'm not a fighter, so I guess it's easy for me to say that. But
look at Daniel Cormier and Cain Velasquez, right? You know, it's like, yeah, some of these guys will never fight. King Mo would have been down. He's a pro wrestling fan. He's seen plenty of brother versus brother angles, you know.
Yeah, I don't think Mo would have had an issue with it. I really don't. But both Lawler and Babalu would be back later in the year on the same card. Actually, the December card for Strikeforce would be memorable for both of them, but for very different reasons. And we'll talk about that when we get there. But that wraps up the event. No fighters pop for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after the fight. Josh, I know that you're going to have something to say about the payroll because you always do, but. Total, gate was $418,000, and that was actually the disclosed fighter payroll. So whether you like it or not, it seems like they gave every dime of the gate to the fighters. But Babalu got $100,000, while Lawler got $85,000, Cyborg got $10,000, Zaramsky's got $5,000, Kennedy and Prangley both took home $30,000, Nunes earned $25,000, while Hewn got $4,000, and I don't have the numbers for the undercard fighters.
That's a tragedy that Connor Hewn got $4,000. I can only hope that he got some other kind of money. He did say he was a replacement in this fight, right? But
I mean, he took it on short notice.
It almost feel like he should get more for being, you know, in a replacement. I mean, $4,000, there are mechanics working across the street from LA Live and the Nokia Theater that are making, you know, more than that, you know, in a month. I can't believe that's all that they could pay for risking their lives. It's just an odd payroll for sure. And I think, it just goes to the whole thing of like this show, like what the heck, why did you need to have it? If you're going to book it in this 5,000, you know, theater, why did they have to do this on a Wednesday? But I'll talk about that in a second.
It was a co-promotional thing with E3 for the video game. I mean, that's really what it came down to. It was a cool location. You know, it was getting into LA, LA, you know, they don't do little things. So I think it made sense from that standpoint. I do have to say, George St. Pierre recently gave an interview where he actually talked money, and he talked about, you know, his disclosed pay for like one of the events. And it was like, no, I actually got a couple million for that fight. And I was making consistently a few million per fight. And that was never his disclosed payroll. So, or his disclosed paycheck. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that the numbers that are released by the state athletic commissions after these UFC, Strikeforce, Bellator, you know, events, that they don't necessarily match up to what the fighter actually gets. You know, they also get sponsorship money, but you know, if you're Connor Hewn and you know you're not a big name, you're probably not going to get a ton. You know, you do have some other money coming in, but you know, I mean, look, most of them, unless it's the guys at the top, most of these guys are not getting rich. So. You know, I would not encourage my kids to go into MMA. It's not worth like the beating that you take on your body, unless you're just like one of those very, very special best ever. It's hard to make that money. So, you know, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that that's not all they got, but I don't know. So, but you know, an entertaining little event. This really did feel more like a challenger's card, even though you had some main guys on there. No title fights, though a couple, one of the fights had, or one or two of the fights had title implications. The crowd was loud. Like I said, I think the intimate setting helped. Nunes Hewn was very entertaining. Tim Kennedy really showcased his toughness and submission skills. He looked primed to establish himself as a star. Cyborg gets a great finish, sets him up as a welterweight contender. Babalu got back in the win column. Very tough night for Lawler. Fans would always come back to watch him fight, so he's always going to have a place. But, definitely not a good look for him. Nothing really major happened on the card, but I thought it was a solid event overall. Josh, what did you think?
Well, now that I think about it, it was like a really good house show, I guess. Yeah. It was entertaining. You had fun. They did make it look better on TV than in real life. In the theater, there were, empty seats toward the back. But the way they made it look on TV, it looked like there's just a lot of really people.
Wait a minute. So was the cage up on a stage? Like you're watching like a play or something?
Yeah. Yes. It was on a stage.
I did PR for an MMA event in the Bay Area, and it was at like the Fox Theater in Petaluma or something like that. And they did that. They put the ring, or I think it was a ring. No, it was a cage. They put it up up on a platform. And it was weird. Like, it was really weird to watch it like that. So, yeah, I didn't notice that from the camera angles, but being the Nokia Theater, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, it was sort of like a quarter of an arena, but they did have the fans on the side. It's like a WWE show, like the hot camera, where there's nobody sitting on the side where the cameras aren't going to go. And so, but they did, instead of filming it from that angle, they filmed it from the kind of the side to make it look like there were people all around. So anyway, it was just sort of interesting to see it that way. It felt less sports and athletic like. It felt, more like a show. But it was interesting. It was good. I was never a big fan of Babalu. I just think that, he just didn't do it for me. His tattoos are great. He had a great neck tattoo. Lawler was not the best Lawler, but KJ Nunes, he did great. Always loved watching him. And then we got a little surprise competitive fight with him and Connor Hewn. And of course, we talked about Tim Kennedy. And I mean, he was at his peak here. I mean, he was just so dominant. And Trevor Prangley was at the end, sort of his best days are behind him. But, Trevor Prangley was also a really good grappler and wrestler. Yep. And Kennedy
very
just
strong.
Made him look like he wasn't. So, I think those things made the show for sure. Was this show on, was it on Showtime?
It drew less than 200,000.
So I guess not a lot of people saw it, but that's because it's a Wednesday night.
Yeah, so Wednesday afternoon. Yeah.
Yeah, it was what it was, but interesting.
All right, well, up next on Inside the Hexagon, again, I sit down with KJ Nunes in what is his first interview since his last fight in 2016. He will not say that he's retired, but it's a fun chat. KJ opens up about his fights with Nick Diaz as well as their outside of the cage confrontations, and then talks about the Connor Hewn fight a little bit. So you'll enjoy that. And then after that, we will be covering Strikeforce Fedor versus Verdun. If you've ever wanted to hear me and Josh cry on the air, this will be the episode for you, because we don't want to talk about it. But both of us were there in person, didn't know each other at that point. And so kind of interesting that all these years later, 10 years later, we're doing a podcast together and talking about the event that we were both at in person. But again, neither of us knew the other, so wouldn't have even known if we even talked or anything like that. But it's an action-packed card. All four main card bouts end in a finish. Josh Thompson's on the card. We get the rematch between Scott Smith and Kung Lee. Chris Cyborg defends her belt against Jan Finney. And then in the main event, Fedor breaks our hearts in a bout with Fabricio Verdun. Again, you want to hear us cry, this may be the episode for that, but it's going to be an interesting one for sure. Make sure you follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at the Hexagon Pod, and you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy. We will see you soon.
Sports stars. They're like superheroes.
But they're actually real.
which is why we've made a podcast about them. You see,
they've all got a story.
But too many of these stories were cut short.
Kobe Bryant.
Payne Stewart.
Flo Jo.
Phil Hughes.
Justin Fashanu.
We're writing episodes about all of them.
And sadly, many more.
Death of a Sports Star. A new series from Crowd Network.